listener-supported non-commercial radio. This is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists.
Next time on Climate One, we look back on 2024 to review major events, climate policies and challenges, and inspiring leaders.
And I believe that it is a movement of angelic dissenters and this movement for justice rooted in love that's not just going to save our planet, but save the people who are here.
This year in climate, on the next Climate One. This is Climate One. We're winding down the last days of December, and what a year it's been. We've talked about new technologies and policies that could help shift the world toward a cleaner future.
Fossil fuels have brought us prosperity, but now we have alternatives. We need to stop stockpiling.
We've had meaningful conversations about how to cope with climate anxiety for ourselves and our kids.
The climate crisis, it's part of a larger polycrisis. It's a lot. It's a lot for them. It's a lot for us. But I think having conversations are really important.
And we've heard from inspiring, motivating leaders about the core principles of justice and equality that are essential to moving forward together.
And I believe that it is a movement of angelic dissenters and this movement for justice rooted in love that say there has to be a subversion to the status quo that's not just going to save our planet, but save the people who are here.
This year in climate, up next on Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton.
I'm Arianna Brocious.
And this is Climate One.
And here we are once again at the end of the year. It's become kind of a tradition for us, Greg, to look back at the year that was and talk about the big moments in climate and, you know, what happened in the last 12 months.
Right. One more year under our belt, and we're going to reflect on some of the most inspiring and empowering conversations we had this year.
So we'll start with the news. Obviously, the biggest story would be the re-election of Donald Trump and what that will mean for the climate. And in sum, it's pretty bad. We spent a whole episode digging into the potential impacts 2 weeks ago, so if you haven't had a chance to listen to that, go back and do so.
There's a lot going on. This is a huge shift in energy production and policy, and Trump plans to erase many of the climate wins of the Biden administration, and he's already appointing people to carry out those plans and attacking anything that's electrical or clean and doubling down on the fossil fuels that are driving extreme weather. And U.S. fossil fuel production is already at an all-time high.
And he wants to expand it even further. Last time Trump was in office, we saw how important the courts were, and that's going to be true again, possibly even more important this time. There's a lot of cases that are being brought for climate and other reasons that could really reshape things.
Right. And the Supreme Court, by undoing the so-called Chevron doctrine, has already opened the door to more deregulation. So that could accelerate. On the other hand, constituencies for clean energy are broader and stronger than the last time Trump came into office. Technologies are more mature, markets are more robust, and more Americans are driving electric cars and making them than ever before. There's a lot of doom and gloom going around, and all is not lost.
And I think that in our bubble as climate folks, thinking about the election, it was kind of easy to assume that a lot of voters would be motivated by the climate emergency we're living in and all the extreme weather we've been seeing, knowing that there's a lot more of that headed our way. But a lot of the post-election analysis has indicated that wasn't the case. Voters responded more to inflation and the economy and social issues like abortion rights.
Right. It's the economy, stupid. And climate really never breaks into the top three. Though it does seem that more people may be ranking climate as a higher priority this year and perhaps going forward. The Environmental Voter Project says they mobilized more than 640,000 first-time climate voters across 19 states. They also recognize that was far too few to change the outcome.
Okay, so Greg, we each brought a trend we've been paying attention to this year to share with our audience. So you go ahead and start.
Right. I think for me, 2024 was the year that AI really came into common use. It's everywhere, and the Silicon Valley hype machine is in full force. And we've already seen how incredibly high AI energy demands are in reshaping our economy. Back in April, I talked with Karen Howe of The Atlantic, who's been reporting on this. One of the most stunning parts of our conversation was hearing her describe walking around a data center in the Arizona desert.
I was in the middle of this really kind of desolate area within Arizona where there's farm fields on one side and then there's kind of just desert land for miles and miles and miles. And when I stepped out, it was like 97 degrees. And that was actually the coldest day of that week. And the first thing that I thought was, well, let me try walking around this data center just to get a bodily sense of how big this is, because I could see it stretching out further than I could see. So I just started walking and thinking, okay, I'm just going to time myself and see how long it takes me to walk around the whole thing. And it did not work. Within two legs of the rectangle, I just started feeling very, very heat exhausted, and I'd run out of water. It had already taken me around 20, 25 minutes. And I was like, I got to get out of here. I'm going to pass out if I don't leave. And it was a really stark kind of illustration of how big these things are, and also where we're actually building these giant silicon monstrosities.
And you've written that Microsoft alone is on pace to build between 50 and 100 new data centers each year for the foreseeable future. How much of that growth is due to AI?
A significant amount of that growth is due to AI. Of course, we can't fully ascertain, because these companies, and Microsoft in particular, does not actually have any transparency into the amount of AI growth that they're experiencing and what share of their data center growth is driving or supporting the AI development and AI use. But you can just see kind of from the historical patterns for Microsoft that once they made this all-encompassing commitment to support OpenAI, which is the main driver of the AI revolution right now, the amount that Microsoft has been spending on data centers has dramatically increased. So they're spending around $10 billion a quarter now, whereas they used to spend just a few billion dollars. And one of the semiconductor analysts has mentioned that this could potentially be the largest infrastructure build out that humanity has ever seen. That is the scale we're talking about. It's bigger than the amount of spend for the Transcontinental Railroad. It's bigger than the space program. So this is the sheer amount of money that Microsoft is funneling at a time when they are supporting all of this AI development is, I think, a signal that a lot of it is tied to that drive.
And since I talked with Karen Howe, things have accelerated. Microsoft reported its emissions jumped 30%, largely due to the AI race. That's putting the company's climate goals at risk. To feed its ravenous energy appetite, Microsoft announced plans to restart power production at the Three Mile Island nuclear plant.
Yeah, it's really kind of scary how much energy these things consume. And also for me, what's kind of scary is how pervasive AI has already become. You know, I'm being prompted to use it on platforms like Zoom, and even just a simple Google search now turns up AI-generated answers, whether or not you want them. They're just built in.
Right. And some of the things are cool, some are a little creepy. And we need to be mindful that AI is a broad category and not all AI activities use massive amounts of energy. There's different types. Predictive AI, which is used in weather forecasting or reading a mammogram, for example, doesn't require nearly the same power as generative AI, which is used in ChatGPT or making fake videos. Still, AI demand for computing power is pushing up electricity prices for regular people.
And this has implications not just for climate, but for climate justice. One of our super compelling guests on the show this year was Tennessee State Representative Justin J. Pearson, and he made that connection.
Yeah, Justin J. Pearson was definitely one of the most inspiring guests of the year. And we talked about this topic of fossil fuels and AI because earlier this year, Elon Musk's company, xAI, swooped in and set up shop in Memphis with very little public knowledge or consent.
And it is kind of amazing, right? They got all this fancy technology and tools, and it's just like, and you can't use that same technology to figure out how to do something in a way that doesn't pollute and kill communities. All this knowledge and information you got, all these resources and scientists you got, and you still can't figure out a way how to have a facility that doesn't use so much energy. Look, this xAI plant currently is using about as much energy as could power 80,000 homes, 1.2 million gallons of water a day. And just recently we learned they're seeking to double this. But the way that it came about is so typical for how projects that exploit communities show up. One day you watch the news and you learn that it's coming. There hasn't been a community meeting. It's in my district and I haven't learned anything about it. City councilors, I called them. They hadn't learned anything about it. It was a deal struck between the Chamber of Commerce, the previous mayor and the current mayor. And then we're all supposed to just celebrate it. But no one asked the real questions about the project. And so when it shows up with 18 fossil gas turbines that are operating every single day, polluting the air quality in a county that already has an F in air quality, in a neighborhood that already has a cancer risk that's 4.1 times the national average, the community is the one that has to fight for itself.
Pearson is such an environmental and climate justice leader. He rose to national prominence for being expelled from the state house after protesting against gun violence in solidarity with his constituents. And he sees clear connections between gun violence and climate change that's driven by burning fossil fuels.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are common threads. I mean, one way is you look at it is this. The same communities that are impacted by pollution are the ones that are being devastated economically with opportunity, being educationally deprived, and are also the most polluted. There's intersection.
So pollution and guns are concentrated in the same places.
In the same places. And it's no coincidence that places that have more lead pipes and the less infrastructure, positive, good infrastructure, are also places where you have incidences of more of the effects of crime or violence. Right? Like the intersection is really about where is our society not caring for people? And where is, as Dr. Mustafa Santiago Ali saying, there being places that are sacrifice zones? And those places overwhelmingly overlap. We can't separate the harms that are happening to our communities, the extraction that's happening from corporations, and the attitudes and the actions of people in power that perpetuate not just pollution, but perpetuate poverty, perpetuate inequality and injustices that have long-term ramifications.
I've heard you talk about people who see this status quo and think like, well, that's just how it is, or that's like the way it always will be. And you mentioned angelic dissenters, people who are comfortable with the status quo and ought to say like, it doesn't have to be like this. Mm-hmm. So let's say a little more about angelic dissenters.
Yeah. The realities that we are experiencing, that our children, our nieces, and our nephews are experiencing, are not isolated, but rather they are part of a lot of systems interplaying and interlocking in ways that oftentimes is creating harm. I think the reality that I learned post George Floyd's lynching and Breonna Taylor's lynching and Ahmaud Arbery's lynching is that we have social structures and systems set up that are leading to these different outcomes for people in all of our communities. And the reality that there's not going to be one singular fix, there's not going to be one singular way. There's going to have to be a way that we think about injustice and think about changing it. And the way that we have to do that is by being angelic dissenters. And that's in two ways. One is that what we are talking about right here is pure. Everybody deserves clean air, clean water, clean soil. I want that for everybody. Right? Like what we are talking about is a pure reality. Everybody deserves access to the opportunity to be who God has called for them to be beloved, right? This is pure. And we have to dissent to a status quo that is saying different. A status quo of economic exploitation, a status quo of educational deprivation, a status quo that says you all deserve to have plants and deserve to have pollution and deserve to have politicians who don't care about you. And then these folks over here, they deserve all the good things. Right? We have to dissent to that. We dissent to unjust policies, unjust practices, unjust people in positions of power. We have to dissent. And I believe that it is a movement of angelic dissenters and this movement for justice rooted in love that say there has to be a subversion to this status quo that's not just going to save our planet, but save the people who are here, save lives of people like my grandmothers, God rest their souls, who died from cancer because of 17 toxic release inventory facilities being around our community. We have to dissent to this, and we have to do it in a way that is pure, that is love-centered, and that is people-centric.
That's really powerful. Angelic dissenters being centered on love and people with inclusion and fierce opposition to a status quo that's hurting people. That's really powerful.
Yeah, I was really in awe of him when we had him on the stage. And he's only been in politics for a few years, so hopefully he's got a long career ahead of him.
Arianna, what was a trend or a person that you kept an eye on this year?
Well, I'm kind of a geek for the electric grid.
Yeah, you are an energy nerd. Yeah.
And I will be honest in saying, part of that's because it is fundamental. We have to have a strong, resilient, reliable grid to accomplish all the climate goals that we want. And our current grid is not that. We are lacking. But also, I think it's this thing that people generally just don't understand. We don't have a great understanding of how the light switch turns on in your house and what makes that happen. It's also like kind of wonky and full of a lot of bad acronyms and like just not that easy to understand. And I've been reading about it and talking about it with people for years and still feel like I've got a lot to learn.
Yeah, it's wonky and nerdy and lots of acronyms. You're right. We just want it to work. I don't really need to want to know how it works. Just bring it to me, please, and reliably and affordably.
Yeah, and you know, it is super essential. You know, the U.S. electric grid right now is too small, too regionalized and outdated to serve our current needs, much less our future needs that we're going to have as we electrify everything. And we need a lot more bandwidth just simply to connect all the hundreds of renewable energy projects currently being built. And we need to interconnect different regions of the country so that if the power goes out in one place, we can send power from somewhere else.
Right. More redundancy. And, you know, all these things are, you know, putting upward pressure on prices. And what we learn from this election is people really care about prices, and rising electricity bills does not bode well for future elections.
So another way we could solve some of these problems is by getting utilities to better plan together, both within and across different regions. Right now, there's kind of a lot of siloing that happens. The agency that regulates most of the utilities around the country is called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. And earlier this year, I spoke with Shelley Welton. She's a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who explained how this process of regional planning works now.
Basically, to shorthand it, they say, like, you should get together in a region and you should make a plan together. You should look ahead, figure out what needs are going to be, and then as a region, pick a set of lines that's going to best meet those needs. In practice, that doesn't really happen very often. What ends up happening more often is that utilities each prefer to build lines within their own service territories that they completely control and that they make money off of. And the region kind of adds up all of these local lines and that becomes the plan. So the ideal is pretty far from the practice at present.
There was some progress made this year when FERC passed a new regulation called Order 1920. It requires utilities, or RTOs, which are regional transmission organizations, they help coordinate multi-state grids. It basically requires them to do a better job of regional planning 20 years into the future and to figure out a way to share the cost of the long-distance lines needed to move that power around. This is such a wonky and important issue. We have to improve our electric grid because it is just not adequate for today's needs. And to complicate matters further, how the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission implements these rules will depend a lot on how much Donald Trump wants to change up the agency leadership when he gets back in office. But one final note on this transmission grid stuff. We also saw a positive development for regional grid planning this year when Western states agreed to create a day-ahead energy market. So again, something we'll keep watching and explaining in future episodes.
Right. As the country decreases its reliance on fossil fuels, as we need to do, it increases its reliance on electricity. We also need new sources of power. One new-ish source we're watching is a growing resurgence of nuclear power. We've already mentioned its use to power AI and data centers. We're also watching the development of newer kinds of reactor technology. Federal money from Biden's signature climate law, the Inflation Reduction Act, has been flowing to support these new technologies.
We spent a recent episode in Wyoming where a company funded by Bill Gates is building a first-of-its-kind new nuclear plant to replace an aging coal-fired power plant. And the company, TerraPower, says they'll offer a job to every former coal plant worker who wants one.
And another energy source gaining power is geothermal.
The heat beneath our feet.
Yeah.
This is so cool. Conventional geothermal power taps hot water just below the Earth's surface. But newer forms of the technology can work with hot rocks alone, and these exist everywhere if you drill deep enough. Advances in drilling that ironically come from the fossil fuel industry could help make geothermal power more viable basically anywhere. Back in February, we talked with Jamie Beard, founder of Project Innerspace, a nonprofit that's working to remove barriers standing in the way of global development of geothermal energy.
Everywhere in the world, below the surface, geothermal exists. Everywhere. The question is only, how deep is it? You know, and in some places, it's not very deep at all. It's really easy to get to. In other places, it's deeper. But it's always there, everywhere in the world. And I think that is the opportunity that makes geothermal really promising and really massive, because that means that we don't need to go to the windiest places. We don't need to go to the sunniest places. We don't need to go to the places in the world where there's oil and gas, right? Geothermal can be produced. You could drill for and produce geothermal feasibly anywhere in the world where there's demand. So that means geothermal could be relevant near the biggest population centers in the world, right? And that's something that is, totally overlooked, but massive opportunity in terms of growth and clean energy.
These technological developments give me just a bit of hope, you know? And they also need support from policymakers all around the world. And that brings us to two big international negotiations that we're watching. One is the annual International Climate Summit we keep an eye on every year, known as the Conference of Parties, or COP. This year's summit was held in Baku, Azerbaijan, and it was supposed to focus on climate finance, which is a broad term that describes the different ways rich countries need to help poorer ones pay to adapt to climate shocks
and also compensate them for losses that have already happened, damage that has occurred because the rich countries produced a lot of the emissions to begin with.
Right. Big fight over who's going to pay. That's where the action is. And initially, it didn't seem like we're going to get much out of the COP this year. There was a lot of reporting about how Saudi Arabia, in particular, was gumming up the works.
Yeah, I think I read the New York Times describe the Saudi team as a wrecking ball in the climate talks.
Yeah, and they've been playing that role pretty much from the beginning for decades. The COP did end its two-week negotiations with something worthwhile, a commitment by rich countries to triple their climate aid to poor nations by 2035. They also agreed to help raise $1.3 trillion in global climate investments. But a lack of specifics, again, for how this will happen, left a lot of leaders disappointed.
We're also watching the UN plastics treaty negotiations. And next week, we'll have a fuller update on the show. But for now, the main takeaway is fairly similar to COP. The fossil fuel producing nations like Saudi Arabia and Russia are using their inherent veto power. This is something all nations have in this consensus-based format to block putting a cap on plastic production. But there's a growing movement of countries that really want to address this problem in a meaningful way.
Right. Every country's drowning in plastic pollution. And those producers will support more recycling, which is kind of a sham, but they don't want to slow the making of plastic, which, of course, comes from oil. There's another round of negotiations next year, so we'll be keeping an eye on that. After the break, we'll revisit more of our most compelling conversations of 2024. Stay with us. This is Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton.
And I'm Arianna Brocious.
This is our end of year show where we take a look back at things we've talked about and been watching over the last 12 months. And one thing that really surprised me was the first ever tornado warning in San Francisco.
Whoa.
Yeah, tornadoes don't happen here. I know they're very damaging other parts of the country. They happen maybe down Southern California, Mexico for sure. And a tornado actually landed and flipped a car near Santa Cruz, about 100 miles or so south of here. Now, I recognize this is one tiny tornado. It pales in comparison to the damage that extreme weather, tornadoes, and hurricanes have caused and the loss of life they've caused in the southeastern United States and many other places.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just a signal that the weather is getting weirder and obviously much more destructive and extreme in a lot of cases. And you're right, there have been some really horrific climate events this year that we've touched on in past episodes. And I have to say, for me, I feel fortunate I didn't experience something that dramatic firsthand. However, I've noticed that just, you know, the way the temperatures are rising where I live and lots of places around the country, it feels very slow and incremental. And so in your day to day, perhaps you don't notice it. I was just at a holiday party where someone was saying, oh, it's so nice. We can be in short sleeves in December.
cringe.
Yeah. You know, but it's true. It's like these mild, slow shifts that we don't notice until it's been a decade and suddenly it's a lot hotter.
We are all frogs in this slowly warming, boiling water. And right. So there's the fast onset and the quick onset, all destabilizing. It raises the question, what can we do about all this? Because we kind of shrug, we go on. I can't affect a tornado or a hurricane. What can I do?
I think that's why I really appreciated one of the episodes we did this year. I really enjoyed making this episode. We called it Wardrobe Malfunction, and it was talking about the climate impact of clothing. I think for a lot of us, climate solutions can sometimes feel out of reach. It can feel like there needs to be such wide scale, high level action that our own actions don't matter. But this is one place where we can really make a difference as consumers. I talked with author and activist Aja Barber about the harms of fast fashion and the hyper-consumptive norms that Americans have grown accustomed to in recent years.
What you need to understand is at the beginning and the end of this linear system, people in the global south are harmed. Most of our clothing, the pricing is artificially depressed. It hasn't risen with the price of other things in our society. And so at the beginning, if you're getting a natural fiber, there's a good chance that someone has exploited in just the growing and selling of the fiber. Cotton farmers notoriously have a very challenging and difficult life to the point where there's a lot of depression among those communities in the global south. If it's not a natural fiber, it's most likely going to be polyester. 60% of the fabrics on our planet currently are polyesters, and polyfibers are plastics. They come from fossil fuels. So I'm pretty sure you've probably done a lot of great shows on the harm of fossil fuels. Don't need to get into it. So
no, but I think we should, let's just pause there for a second, because I think that sometimes we forget that we're literally wearing like oil. It's an oil derivative, right? It's a product that's made from fossil fuels.
Yes. We don't really know how long it's going to take for a lot of these polyfibers to biodegrade. And when you wash polyfibers, they shed microfibers, and those microfibers get into our water, our soil, our food, our bodies. And so that's not a good system either. So, you know, you're either buying cotton or something that is synthetic. The product will then be produced most likely in the global south. And the people producing and putting together the garment are humans. 80% of garment workers are women. Chances are that woman is also going to be brown or black. And because we buy so much more clothing now than we did in, per se, 1990, we are cycling through garments at a speed that the planet cannot keep up with.
So I just want to recap, because you've touched on so many important things. So from, you know, the beginning, getting the material, the raw material, there's pesticide use, water use, land use, exploitation of labor. And then, of course, the emissions of actually making the products and then getting them to us, especially when they're made all the way across the world. That's quite a lot. And so you write something in your book that I found very powerful, which is this system isn't broken at all. It's working exactly the way it's supposed to, meaning the system of extraction and exploitation with colonial roots. So can you expand a bit more on that?
Yeah, I think that when we talk about colonialism, even when we learn about something like chattel slavery, we are so removed from it. We don't think about the transatlantic slave trade as being the absolute foundation of today's fast fashion system. But the truth is, what chattel slavery allowed was for the Industrial Revolution to happen. So then, therefore, we could produce garments in a lot more of a fast manner, basically. And people were able to do that because there was a lot of unpaid, exploited labor, slaves. When we learn about the transatlantic slave trade in schools, we talk about cotton in this very removed way. We don't talk about it as the fabric in our wardrobes. We talk about it like it's just some random raw material. But in actuality, that cotton allowed for the industry to thrive and grow in a way that it couldn't have grown before. And a lot of that was built on the backbreaking labor of my ancestors.
There's so much in that little bit of tape there. And I really encourage listeners to check out the whole episode on clothing and climate. But if you haven't had a chance to listen, here are just a few tips to leave you with as a consumer of clothing or really any goods. First, buy less. You know, if you can, wear and repair what you have longer. If you're going to buy things secondhand or used is great. And if you're going to buy new things, look for brands that have commitments to workers' rights, fair labor, and sustainability metrics. But obviously, as we heard from Aja, the roots of colonialism are deep, and they impact so many ways of the way our world works today. More recently, I talked with climate justice activist Mitzi Janelle Tan of the Philippines. We talked ahead of this year's UN climate conference.
To start on the global scale, even the IPCC or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports now say that colonialism is a reason why countries are vulnerable to the climate crisis. And we see this on different levels. On the capitalism side, we see that global emissions started to rise more rapidly during the 1800s, during the Industrial Revolution. And then when we look at how the industrialization process happened, it came from taking resources from the lands, from the global south, from the colonized peoples. And so there you already start to see the interplay of how that process of colonialization led to the over-extraction of resources that have destroyed our natural ecosystems, our biodiversity, and in that process made us more vulnerable to the climate crisis because the forests are being cut down, there are quarries, there are large mining sites, and that's causing floods and landslides. That's being caused by the emissions that's using these resources. And so it starts to loop into each other. And additionally on that, you also see in the imperialism side, especially the militarization aspect, where the US military trains the Philippine military and they train the Philippine military in counterterrorism, and how the military in the Philippines uses counterterrorism is to attack environmental defenders, indigenous peoples who are fighting against environmentally destructive projects. And that's why the Philippines is one of the most dangerous countries in the world for environmental defenders and activists, because they say that anyone who is fighting for human rights, especially usually the ones who are going up against the ones that are taking the resources from the land, so the indigenous peoples, our small farmers, our small fisher folk, they tag them as terrorists. And there you see that culture of impunity coming from our previous colonizers, the US.
Wow. I just have to sit with that for a second. That's a lot. So, considering yourself as an anti-imperialist activist, how do you feel moving through these United Nations conferences where the most powerful players, arguably, are still these imperial mm-hmm. or formerly imperial powers?
Mm-hmm. It's difficult because you see how the structures in place are still there in small things and in big things. In small things in the sense that who has the biggest resources to send a big team of negotiators? It's the global north countries. And what that means practically is that they can keep going on and on and just switching out their people throughout the negotiations. But countries mm-hmm. from smaller island states and smaller countries have less people to send because they have less resources, which then means at the end of the day, it's like past midnight, they're tired and they won't hold the line as strongly. Yeah, we'll give in to what the global north is saying. And they have a lot more resource and a lot more energy. And then you also see the other parts where the U.S. has been for a long time very concretely like saying that the loss and damage fund is not something that we need. And then at the very end, suddenly saying, oh, okay, we do need the loss and damage fund, but we can't afford it. How the U.S., one of the largest countries and richest countries in the world, say that they can't afford to give anything into the loss and damage fund.
I was really struck by the way Mitzi and Aja, and in fact, several of our guests, brought up this underlying legacy of colonialism and the problems it's still causing today. It helped broaden my view of how hard it can be and how important it is to challenge these entrenched systems. You know, Mitzi didn't attend this year's climate conference in Baku, Azerbaijan, and she wasn't alone.
Right. A lot of people skipped it, including Climate One. And we're starting to see critiques from major international climate figures that these conferences and the whole structure of unanimous decision making on climate isn't working anymore. I think they said it's not fit for purpose. There are some calls to redesign or reimagine this entirely, and it gets to some really hard problems about sharing power.
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath that that's actually going to happen, the redesign, because that would be incredibly contentious. But fortunately, there are other approaches gaining ground that are trying to stem the flow of harmful emissions into the atmosphere. One of them is the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty.
This is really interesting, and it addresses this problem. Earlier this year, I talked with the group's chair, Zipporah Berman.
The Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty is an initiative that is designed to ensure greater international cooperation between nation states to curb the expansion of fossil fuels, the production of fossil fuels. Because to date, we have had climate policy and international agreements that focus on emissions or pollution, countries agreeing how much they will pollute, negotiating on the space left in the atmosphere. And we haven't had any agreements on who gets to produce and how much. And so this treaty is designed to provide new global governance around the production of fossil fuels, to align the production of fossil fuels with a global carbon budget and our climate goals. But what really inspired me to create the Fossil Fuel Treaty is the idea that this strange kind of groupthink that we have going on, that we're in a transition, but we can just keep growing the problem. We're on track today to produce 110% more oil, gas, and coal than we can ever burn under a 2-degree world. So why are we putting all of our financial and intellectual and political effort into digging up more stuff that we know we can't use?
That argument makes so much sense to me. And yet, we saw voters in the U.S. re-elect Donald Trump, someone who describes climate change as a scam and who's been very clear about his intentions to further expand and increase domestic oil and gas production. So I don't know how much pressure this treaty will have on the U.S.
Yeah, probably not a lot when the U.S. is going to back to America first, a little more isolationist stance. And let's be honest, voters did not vote on climate. They don't. Maybe gas prices, electricity prices. Climate wasn't talked about very much in this election.
So how do we stay hopeful in the climate chaos? After the break, we'll hear from several people who have ideas on how to do that.
I've learned that pointing to the solutions, like local solutions, is really helpful, both for my kids and for me, so that we don't drown in anxiety about it.
That's up next.
This is Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton.
And I'm Arianna Brocious.
When I first started covering climate a couple decades ago, most people viewed it as something far away in time and place for our grandkids over there. But in recent years, it started to shift.
Yeah, many parts of the world have been feeling climate impacts, increased drought, higher temperatures, bigger storms for years. And it seems now that people in the wealthier parts of the world are really beginning to feel the impacts of climate in their own lives. One of the viral climate moments this year was when career weatherman John Morales of NBC6 in South Florida got emotional on air describing the characteristics of rapidly intensifying Hurricane Milton.
It's just an incredible, incredible, incredible hurricane. It has dropped It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologize. This is just horrific. And it is just gaining strength in the Gulf of Mexico. The seas are just so incredibly, incredibly hot. You know what's driving that. I don't need to tell you. Global warming, climate change.
This happened when the news was still fresh with images of Hurricane Helene, which of course wreaked havoc on the East Coast, killed more than 230 people. And so for Floridians who know and trust you, this did really drive home the urgency of this particular storm. And I'm curious, what have you been seeing and reading and researching in your career that has gotten to today where we're really seeing these incredible storms happen?
Yeah. Well, for perspective, people have to realize that 2024 is my 40th anniversary as a professional meteorologist. It's been a long, long time. And my entire career has always been in the tropics and subtropics. I've been monitoring, analyzing, and forecasting hurricanes for 40 years, right? So the changes I've observed them in real time, and there have been changes. These are things that are backed up by peer-reviewed science, right? And there is definitely a greater proportion of the tropical cyclones that are forming anywhere in the world that are reaching violent category 4 and 5 intensities. It's not that there are more tropical storms and hurricanes as a whole. It's not that the count of every single tropical storm and hurricanes is higher, but the percentage of the ones that are forming are reaching these incredible intensities. And it's just happening at the drop of a hat now. One of these days, there's going to be a mundane tropical storm in the central Bahamas, which 36 hours later is going to make landfall in Miami as a category 4 hurricane and catch everybody off guard. That's my market, okay? This is the market I've been on TV for 33 years, an audience that knows me very, very well. And they've known me as a non-alarmist, as a just-the-facts meteorologist. But if now there's a higher chance than there's ever been in our lifetimes for a 50-mile-an-hour tropical storm in, you know, the central Bahamas, making it to Miami as a Cat 4 a day and a half later, if that's the case today, I'm not sure I can continue to be a non-alarmist. It's changed the way that I deliver the weather.
And, you know, I think weathercasters, local weather people, really occupy this unique space in the sort of climate communication landscape, right? You're in people's homes. You're trusted. People expect to see you and hear from you daily. And they make decisions based on the information that you give them.
You know, extreme weather events multiplied in this century, starting in the aughts through the teens and now into the 20s. Every year, we get more billion-dollar disasters in the U.S. We see more severe flooding all around the world. Heat waves are becoming longer and more extreme and deadlier as well. All these are symptoms of a warming climate. And when these things happen, and they're part of my weather segment, I normally follow it by saying something as simple as, what you're seeing here happen is consistent with what you would expect in a warming planet and was predicted to happen decades ago by climate scientists. And that allows people to make that connection. And it's important that broadcast meteorologists do that more often.
Yeah, weathercasters are really powerful local messengers. They're one of the few people that people on the left and the right still listen to and comment.
You know, I think so much of covering climate can feel like 2 steps forward, 1 step back, or maybe even like 2 or 3 steps back.
Yeah.
Still, we had some really uplifting moments of conversation in this last year, and one of them that feels especially timely right now was your conversation with California Attorney General Rob Bonta.
Right, and we're going to be hearing more about him. He's going to be on the front line of the coming suits and battles between California and the incoming Trump administration. We talked in May about the civil lawsuit, something different, that he filed against ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, BP, and their lobbying group, the American Petroleum Institute, known as API. This suit alleges that the industry has known since the 1960s that burning fossil fuels could warm the planet in damaging ways. Then, instead of alerting the public about the harms of their product, they chose to downplay or outright deny the effects.
The short of it is that these fossil fuel companies and the API, the American Petroleum Institute, they knew about global warming and predicted with terrifying accuracy where we would be today with extreme weather and global warming and climate change, and they lied about it. It was bad for business. They knew internally, they acknowledged internally with memos and conversations the truth of climate change, but externally to the public, to the world, they lied and they denied climate change. And they didn't just fail to talk about it. They had a very sophisticated, strategic public relations approach to how they denied it. They hired a firm and they created front groups and they placed and planted op-eds, all saying the opposite of what they internally acknowledged. And so this is a climate change deception case. We have filed it in San Francisco Superior Court. We are the biggest geographic entity and biggest economy to sue these fossil fuel companies for this conduct. We think it's a game changer. We think it's a massive transformational moment in terms of accountability. And we believe in a simple premise. One, you shouldn't lie to the people of this state, of this country, of this world. And two, you should be held accountable and pay for the damage that you created because of that deception and because of those lies.
The case against the oil majors, as they're called, is still working its way through the courts, but a decision that holds these companies accountable for their deceit could be really meaningful.
I want to change gears a little bit and revisit a more personal approach to dealing with climate anxiety and how we can help the next generation process this. I talked with Emily Robitaux, author of Mothering Against the Apocalypse, about meeting the challenge of this moment that we're living in head on. She's a mother of two boys, and one of them, the older one, had a period where he was just fascinated by extreme weather.
We went to this exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History, which is the go-to place for parents in New York on rainy days. So, but he was really little when we encountered that exhibit. He was like four or something, but he got really deep into violent weather to the degree that he went through all the books in our local public library in his age range on wow. that subject. The librarian had to like apologize to him and be like, sorry, Geronimo, we have no more books. I think I'm similar to him in that I feel safer about a scary subject when I know more about it. And also, you know, when we were at that exhibit, my husband and I did feel a degree of trepidation about like, wait, there was this map of New York City. It was showing like the five boroughs and all the lights going out as it looked when Sandy struck. It was showing like the rising waters, and it was like a touchscreen map. And it was just at the level, almost like coffee table level. It was like at a child's level where they could look at it. But it was making us really scared that what he was witnessing at a really young age was how at risk our city is, in particular, to the rising sea.
I think it's extremely hard to be able to face your children and be honest and truthful with them about what, I don't know, what dangers there are in the world. And and also not scare them. So I don't know. How do you find a way through that?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about what intergenerational justice looks like in practice. And I think it's like working together, like listening to the questions they're asking of us, trying to answer the questions that they're asking. In my case, like I've learned that pointing to the solutions, like local solutions, is really helpful, both for my kids and for me, so that we, you know, we don't like drown in anxiety about it. You know, the climate crisis, it's part of a larger polycrisis. It's a lot. It's a lot for them. It's a lot for us. But I think having conversations are really important. Whenever I start to feel overwhelmed, like by the task of parenting in this era, not only parenting in this era, but like just being in this era, it's this climate emotions wheel. This is put out by the Climate Mental Health Network. Anyway, it's this like wheel that it has like, and the wheel is broken up into four kind of color quadrants. One color quadrant is anger, and that's the red zone. And the emotions attached to anger that it names are indignation, outrage, frustration, betrayal, and disappointment. I find myself there a lot. And there's another zone, which is the purple zone, which is sadness. I find myself in this zone a lot too, which the emotions it names are despair, loneliness, loss, depression, grief, shame, and guilt. And then there's the positivity space, which is blue. And this is like the interesting one that we don't often think of like as attached to what it means to parent and live in the climate crisis. But I have to say, like, the more nuanced I've been like forced into thinking about the emotions by this card, the more I see, like, I feel these things too, like interest, empowerment, inspiration, empathy, gratitude, and hope. And then there's a fear space, overwhelm, panic, powerlessness, anxiety, and worry. And what I feel like when I talk about this stuff with my kids is like, it's okay to despair. We're often told, like, don't despair, as if that's a thing that
you can switch off.
We might get stuck in.
Okay, don't despair.
Right. That you could switch off. Well, that you could switch off. But I think the fear is that that's like a swamp of feeling that one cannot exit. right? That you'll get sucked down as if it's quicksand or something. But I think, like, there's so much to despair about. It should feel despairing on occasion, so long as we're not stuck there. It's also really cool to look and see, look, they're unburying this river, and that's going to help with flooding. And do you know how many people in our neighborhood and in this city at multiple levels have been working on that for years, and we get to live in its watershed? And that's pretty cool. And like, another feeling that that makes me feel is like, it's like a feeling of being in community, right? Like the joy of working on a problem with other people.
As we get near the end, we have to touch on one of the great highlights of the year, which is hosting the iconic Jane Goodall at a live event in San Francisco. We get to interact with a lot of amazing people, and the fandom for Jane Goodall is just next level. It really is, to see so many people excited about a 90-year-old scientist. She's just so good at connecting with people in a very calm, direct way, despite her frenetic lifestyle.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, I do travel all over the world, just about. And everywhere, and just about every culture, there are people, more and more people, passionate about the environment. I think that's one very positive bit of news, that more and more people understand, more and more people want to do something about the climate. Well, I've got this youth program, and the youth are in this program. They're passionate about making the world better, and they care, and they act. It's all about taking action. There's about 1,500 groups in across mainland China, for example. So this understanding of what we're doing to the planet is growing.
And for those younger people who are facing their own climate anxiety, Jane has this advice.
It's very simple. I tell them to join Roots and Shoots, our youth program, because I don't think there's a single child, and we are kindergarten through university, who doesn't join Roots and Shoots, take an active role in it, and feel hopeful about the future. Hundreds of them have told me, I feel completely different now. I feel there is hope for the future. The reason it's called Roots and Shoots is because if you think of a big tree, you love trees, I know. You probably love trees. Many people out there. Well, think of your favorite tree. It probably began with a little seed. And when it started to grow, there'd be little roots and a little shoot. And if you picked it up, it would seem so weak and powerless. And yet there's a life force, a magic in that seed, so that those little roots to reach the water can work through rocks and eventually push them aside. And that little shoot to reach the sun can work through a brick wall and eventually knock it down.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening.
Our team includes Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Ariana Brocious, Austin Cologne, Megan Basilia, and Ben Testani. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Greg Dalton.
Listener-supported non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. You are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported non-commercial radio featuring local and independent artists.
time. That's why my baby stayed. Yes, I traveled all the time. That's why my baby stayed.